Thank you for downloading this Hay Festivals podcast. For more information about the Hay Festivals globally and to access our archive, please visit hayfestival.org. Thank you.
Okay, good morning. My name is Yadvinder Mali. I'm from the University of Oxford. And together with my colleague Charles Godfrey, we're going to talk about two chapters from a book that has just been released by Oxford University Press called Is the Planet Full? And what this book does is take a broad look at this question of the carrying capacity of the planet and how humans occupy that from a variety of perspectives, from philosophical and ethical perspectives, from biosphere science, ecosystem science, looking at water and food in many aspects. And the book's here, and we'll be signing the book afterwards. For this talk, we'll focus on the two chapters that Charles and I have contributed. So first, I'll take a look at this question of how do we measure the human impact on the planet? How can we say how much does humanity fill the planet? And then we'll follow on with Charles taking an example of the question around food and food supply in the 21st century and some of the issues raised around that. We are a visual species, and sometimes an image or a photograph can convey and embed an idea much more than an abstract idea that existed before. And one of these transformations, I believe, occurred in the 1960s and 70s when images like these started emerging from the first satellites and spacecraft. And this is from Apollo 17, which began to show images of the Earth as a whole. And we knew before that the Earth was a single planet, but this captured it deep in our psyche and our popular imagination. And this triggered a number of things. It triggered the environmental movement. But the two key aspects I think it did trigger was once a realization that we were all on one planet together. And with our different cultures and civilizations and politics, we were all stuck on one planet together and had to find a way of coexisting. And also, it triggered a realization that this planet was finite, that it was small, relatively small compared to the vastness of the universe, and we all had to find a way of managing our lives and existing, managing our civilization on this planet. I think in the last few years, another image has appeared from satellite data again, which focuses on flying over the planet and observing the planet at night. And I think it also captures something seminal and embeds it in our psyche. And this is an image at night where you see the glow of cities across the planet and from gas flares and other aspects. And what it really shows is how prominent humanity has become and how comparable it is to other processes in the planet. It used to be said that you could only see the Great Wall of China from space. Now you can see a multitude of human processes and activities from space. But all these activities are built on the natural processes and cycles of the planet. And those planet's processes are the things that sustain these activities. So the question that arises is how large can these activities become before they begin affecting the life support systems and the processes in which those activities are embedded? And that's one question that I will look at in my presentation. So a question I want to examine is how do we measure how big humanity is relative to the Earth? And by big, I don't mean just simply how many of us are on the planet, but what we're doing, how active we are. So we need a concept that captures activity as well as simply the numbers of people. And I want to introduce the concept of metabolism. And all of us have a metabolism. We have a biological metabolism. As we're sitting here, we're burning stored sugars and energy and producing to maintain our bodies, to produce heat. All organisms, whether plants or animals, have a biological metabolism. But also humans are particular in that we have a much larger extended or social metabolism. There are lots of aspects of energy that we use in our lives that have nothing to do with our direct biological maintenance, but are part of how we function in society, in our lives. And this is what I call social metabolism or extended metabolism. And I want to explore how big this our overall metabolism, including the social metabolism, is relative to our biological metabolism. And I'll be using units of watts. And just to calibrate this is an old-fashioned tungsten light bulb. That's about 60 watts of energy, 60 joules per second of energy coming out. So it's a measure of power. And so when I talk about watts, bear that in mind. And sometimes when you scale up, I'll be talking about gigawatts. And a large power station typically has a power output of about a gigawatt. So you can use those to scale things. So let's go back in time, or let's go to parts of the world where humans still live at a pre-agricultural state. Let's look at the biology and the metabolism, the energy flow through this society. A human being, an adult human being, typically has a metabolism of around 120 watts, so equivalent to about two light bulbs. That's what we're constantly burning, two light bulbs inside our bodies to maintain ourselves, to keep going. In a pre-agricultural society, there is an extended metabolism. We all used fire for cooking. We may have there's inefficiencies in capturing and hunting things. So our extended metabolism would have been around 300 watts. And this is the state of all of us 10,000 years ago, you know, where all of humanity was a hunter-gatherer in one form or another. And we were just extracting some resources from the environment, and the maximum possible population densities were quite low, around one person every 10 square kilometers. So if we multiply those two numbers together, we were pulling out around 30 watts of energy from the environment for every square kilometer. So half a light bulb or a high efficiency light bulb for every square kilometer. And if we compare this to the environment in which we originated in the savannas of East Africa, the natural biological metabolism, the flow of energy through that environment is more like 30 megawatts per square kilometer. So we were just pulling out around 1/1,000,000th of the energy of the biosphere around us in this hunter-gatherer state. All this began to change with the agricultural revolution that began in various places around the world between 5,000 and 8,000 years ago. And it originated soon after the end of the last ice age and independently in many areas of the world, from Mexico to the Amazon to the West Africa, New Guinea, East Asia. And they're suggesting that there was a transition that was almost inevitable at that stage with a stable climate to this agricultural societies. And a key aspect of agriculture is that rather than simply drawing off a few resources from the natural ecosystem, it's an active colonization of the ecosystem. We transform the ecosystem for our purposes to draw out the biological energy of the ecosystem and to use it to support our populations. And ultimately, one feature of that is you can make it more and more efficient, but ultimately it's constrained by land area. There's only, if you want to really draw much more energy out of a system, you have to have more land for your population or your tribe or your group. And if we look at the energy of pre-industrial humanity, this could be, say, England in the 17th century, for example, the extended metabolism is now much higher. It's gone up to about 2,000 watts per square meter because we're pulling out much more energy from these colonized ecosystems to support ourselves, to support our domesticated animals, to provide meat. It's increased by an order of magnitude. But the key feature is that with such an abundance of biological energy, we can support much higher population densities. So around 40 persons per square kilometer is typical. So per unit area, we've ramped up to around 80 kilowatts of energy being extracted from the biosphere per unit area. And when we compare that to the natural ecosystem, say a temperate woodland that would have existed in England prior to agriculture, this is about 5% of the biological energy of that natural ecosystem. So it's beginning to become significant, still not overwhelming, but significant compared to the natural processes. And metabolism is important not simply because we draw directly from the biosphere, but it's the capacity to do work, it's the capacity to transform the environment around us. The more metabolically active we are, the more we are able to transform our environment and to affect the environment through our waste products. This gives you two static snapshots. If we look at this picture over time, and this is derived from a book by Ian Morris, modified and analyzed the data slightly, and this compares the extended metabolism throughout human history from 14,000 BC to 2000 AD. The blue line is what is termed the West here, which includes the Middle East, so it's everywhere from from Mesopotamia westwards, and each including Egypt, and the east is China and the regions around China. And what you see is, with the agricultural revolution starting, both areas go up. The west, the Middle East, and in particular, is ahead of China, and things rise rapidly until around 2,000 years ago. And I've cut out the last few centuries in this, which would go off the scale. You'll see them in a moment. But let's so that you can see this process of transformation was gradual and rapid. But if we zoom in to the last 4,000 years, we see something quite interesting, that it seemed to come to a halt around 2,000 years ago with the Roman Empire in Britain and the Han Dynasty in China. And what I propose is going on here is that these systems actually became, these civilizations became agriculturally full. That they were full by the definition of the energy supplies that were available at the time, the land area that was available to support the populations and the density of populations. And when a society... So fullness is partly a definition depending on the technologies you have. And as technologies change, fullness can change. But societies that are full are vulnerable to shocks as well. So these may look like small changes over time, but these are areas that were... A famine, one year of failed crops can trigger a famine, and a population decline can trigger proximate things such as invasion from of outside peoples. And so the system becomes much more sensitive to small shocks, and the civilizations become more sensitive. And over the last 1,000 years, China, in many ways, in terms of activity and energy, was ahead of medieval Europe, post-Roman Empire. And it was only in the 18th century that the West returned to the levels of metabolism that the Roman Empire had. And then since then, it surged. And what happened in the 18th century, of course, is that we managed to find a different source of energy that broke us out of the fullness of the agricultural constraints. And that was finding energy that was embedded by the biosphere, not around us, but in deep time, fossil fuels, so oil, coal, things captured by the biosphere millions of years ago and buried deep down that we could pull out and give us an abundance of rich energy. And that fuels our lifestyles today. My son Luke asked to be credited for pulling this slide together for me yesterday. And it's not all. Sometimes we can think of fossil fuels as a villain, but there are many aspects of our lives that are powered by this abundance of energy. We're all here because we're children of this energy abundant age. Our healthcare systems, our education systems are built on an assumption of abundant energy. People can specialize in things more than gathering food to feed themselves, and that creates our complex societies. And once you move into cities, it becomes even more dense. So we can have thousands of people per square kilometer, a hypermetabolism. So let's look at the numbers, taking the example of England. So just the area of this, and this is England, not Britain, so that I've done these calculations. The social metabolism of the average English person is around 8,000 watts. So again, a much higher value. We've gone up four times per person since the agriculture, since the Industrial Revolution, drawing much more, and much of that comes from the extra extraction of energy, mainly from fossil fuels. Our population density have rocketed to around 400 persons per square kilometer, 10 times higher than it was prior to the Industrial Revolution. We can support that because of the abundance of energy. And if we compare the natural ecosystem metabolism off the biosphere of England, it's around 200 gigawatts, so 200 power stations worth of, large power stations worth of energy flowing through the English biosphere. Whereas the human metabolism sitting on top of that biosphere is around 400 gigawatts. So in the context of England, and it's largely the same for all of Britain, our biological activity as humans is twice as large as the natural activity of the ecosystems around us, all the energy being used. And it's not surprising that we're transformed. This is a very transformed landscape, a very transformed ecosystem. And you can look at this over time as well. This is an animation. It shows carbon dioxide emissions since 1750. And that's a good, as most of our metabolism is now from fossil fuels, it's a good proxy for the metabolism. So think of this as the energy, the metabolism of different parts of the world. And you can see until the mid-19th century, this high energy is packed into this island of Western Eurasia and so adjoining areas. It starts spreading into the Eastern North America by 1880. But really, localized, the amount of energy to transform the world. You can understand a lot of human history where you understand where the energy available in cultures and civilizations was. It's in the 20th century, it starts spreading, Japan lights up, and really around now, 1950, suddenly there's a massive transformation, and large areas of the world start developing an industrial metabolism. This is often termed the Great Acceleration, around 1950, when things transform hugely. And another way of thinking about this is how big, larger animals tend to have a larger metabolism. We have a larger metabolism than a mouse. How large would we have to be to have the metabolism, a biological metabolism, the same size as our social metabolism? If you can work out the calculations, and it turns out we'd have to be 15 tons each in our biological metabolism. So if you want an alternative perspective of what it's like to live here, imagine 60 million 15-ton apes roaming the landscape, and you can understand how we transform our world around us. So, and that only not only pulls on fossil fuels, but that enables us to draw more energy from the biosphere around us. And this is a map of what's called appropriation of biosphere production that shows how much we're pulling out off the natural bias production of the biosphere around the world. And you can see areas, particularly with old civilizations and a high density of populations, India, East Asia, Europe in particular, are pulling out most of the energy, the biological energy the biosphere can provide. So in many ways, they're approaching a limit. And the reason that they can maintain that is that they draw in energy from other parts of the biosphere, South America, Brazilian soybeans from South America, et cetera, things that power our local society. So it's really by drawing in outside of our local constraints that we're able to achieve such high levels. But we are approaching a level where there is nowhere else to draw in from at this global scale. So if we calculate this at a global scale, the natural metabolism of the biosphere is around 150 terawatts, which is a million watts of energy. If we estimate pre-agricultural global human populations, the total metabolism of humanity was around 0.002% of the biosphere. So we were probably less influential on the planet than, say, elephants in terms of our impact on the biosphere. If we go to agricultural humanity, our impact was larger, stretching up to about 2% of the metabolism of the biosphere, but still moderate. If we look at modern human industrial or semi-industrial humanity, the calculations come up to about 17%. And this is substantial. And we have to remember, we cannot approach 100% because we want to have a biosphere for other creatures, even being in the same order of magnitude as 100% is probably a strong limit on how high we can go. But if we look to the future, if we look at global UN projections of population and energy use, by 2050 we'd be at about 32% of the biosphere being human metabolism being the size of that. Look at, say, what about everyone was at the standard of living globally that China has today? And that is a lower standard of living than most of you are accustomed to in this room. But if we had the lifestyle of an average modern Chinese person in terms of energy consumption, that would be pushing up to 40% of the biosphere. And if we aspire for the American dream and go to a global population of 2050 having the same energy use as in a modern North American, we'd be looking at a human metabolism that's 120% of the natural metabolism of the biosphere. So clearly, the planet isn't full, but it's filling up in terms of the activities we do, and we're hitting our hard limits in terms of what the planet can provide. So if we return to this image of energy use over time, but we see what we've been in the last century, and particularly in the last 50 years, is this period of metabolic inflation, where our energy use has been expanding decade on decade, generation on generation, and we've come to see this as a normal way of being. It's a crisis where our energy use isn't growing year on year. It causes economic problems. It causes shocks. But it's a very unusual state to be in terms of the long-term history of humanity. And it isn't a norm. And at some point, it's going to hit boundaries, probably quite soon. So, and from this perspective, it's inevitable that things like climate change are a question. We can quibble about whether a particular warming signal is occurring or not. But the fact that the sky is small compared to our overall activity means that to ignore climate change is like pouring car exhaust into your living room, and to ignore that there will be impacts and consequences from that. If you look at many metrics over time, you probably can't read them from there, but anything from the number of telephones, the number of McDonald's restaurants, to water use, everything's been ramping up in the last 50 years in particular. And this is captured by this idea of planetary boundaries that's become popular, that there are limits in many processes. Some of them we may already be passing the boundaries in terms of nitrogen cycling and biodiversity loss, and others that we may be approaching, such as climate change. And so to conclude, many pre-industrial societies were full. And fullness is partially a definition of the technology you have. And much of human history has been this competition between fullness and capacity and innovation to break through those constraints. But there are large periods of human history where it wasn't clear which direction we were going. The Industrial Revolution opened up access to previously unavailable energy from deep time ecosystems, from the fossil ecosystems. And we are still in a period of metabolic inflation that we have come to regard as normal, but it's only a few generations deep, and there's no inevitability that this period can continue. This period is now hitting constraints in both resource supply and in waste production, constrained by the sheer size of our human presence compared to the size of the planet. So our challenge in the 21st century is to navigate a transition from this period of metabolic inflation to a sustainable global state, while still managing to provide well-being for humanity and a living space for the rest of the biosphere. And this will require, it's always been a challenge for humans in history, and this will require extensive innovation, both technological innovation, I think that is a key part of it, but also innovation in governance and how we govern our global commons. And a theme of this book in many chapters is exploring this idea of innovation and how governance and innovation in governance in particular can manage this transition to a full planet. Okay, thank you. So I'll just hand over to my colleague, Charles.
Thanks very much, Yavinder. So I'm going to be talking about one of the aspects of the challenges ahead that Yavinder talked about, and that is, can we feed 10 billion people sustainably and equitably? And it's a great pleasure to share a stage with Yavinder, who's a colleague of mine at Oxford, but with busy lives. We sort of meet in corridors. And I remember the last time Yavinder and I spent any time together, which was in one of the few places on Earth that's wetter than Y. It's the rainforest of Borneo, which is wet, it's muddy, and interestingly, the mud is exactly the same color as the mud outside. And I think it's just a matter of time before we have orangs and leeches in Wales as well. But of course, our pleasure at two professors getting up and talking may not be your pleasure. I have an office at home, and I'll sometimes come back and find that my wife, the guilty party sitting in the front row, will put a little note on my screen. And she picked this out of The Guardian the other week, a wonderful quote from W.H. Auden defining what a professor is. Now, Yavinder kept you awake, and I'll try and do the same in the next 12 minutes or so. So why should we worry about food? I'm going to spend a couple of slides trying to argue that there is something we need to worry about and something that needs really quite urgent policy attention. And then I'm going to spend three slides giving you what I think needs to be done. And then I'm going to directly answer the question at the end, can we feed 10 billion people? So demand for food is going to go up, and demand for food is going to go up because there are more people on the planet. We'll probably hit about 10 billion people towards the middle of this century, and then hopefully the populations will plateau at that time. There's some variation around it in the green haze around there, and that's largely because we don't know what's going to happen, particularly in Africa. And I know some of you were at the energy stage a little while ago to hear a superb talk by Sarah Harper, who's also contributed a chapter to the book, to the Is the Planet Full book. So populations are going to go up, but my academic background as a population biologist, it's extraordinary good news that we can intellectually talk about global populations coming to a plateau. Now, one of the reasons that we're having fewer kids is that populations are getting more wealthy. And again, that's a good thing. We want people to come out of poverty. But if you're wealthy, you demand a richer diet and a diet that needs more resources to produce. For example, more meat. So I'm going to put, this is some UN figures on meat consumption. And that's us in the developed nations. It's actually going down slightly in Europe, but it's generally going up. I did give this talk in Oxford to some undergraduates, and I sort of quipped, well, we in the rich world, the Americans, it's physically impossible to eat more meat than we do. And the next day, I got this slide sent from one of the undergraduates saying, no, no, you're wrong, we can eat meat. So the next time I gave more meat than we do at the moment, next time I gave the lecture, I put this up. The following day, another undergraduate emailed and said, well, look on the bright side. Interleaved between the burgers is at least three of your five a day vegetables. So we in the rich world eat a lot of meat. And if we look at the developing world, China in particular is converging on a Western diet. Interestingly, India, which in many ways is going through the same development trajectory, is not converging or not converging as fast. But almost literally, for reasons that Yuvinda has talked about, the world, a population of 10 billion people cannot eat the rich diets that we enjoy in Europe and North America. So let me talk about some of the coming challenges on the food system. The first one I've just mentioned, that we're going to see this continuing demand for continuing growth in demand. Urbanization is something that has really crept up. Again, in Yuvinda's slides, where you saw the wonderful pictures from space of where the light is, we now have getting on to 20, 25 cities in the world with over 10 billion inhabitants. Cairo, that picture was taken in Cairo during the Arab Spring. Cairo is heading, it's about 9.5 million people now, and a population of 91 million people in Egypt, the biggest importer of wheat anywhere in the world. If we get the global supply and demand of food wrong, if we find that commodity prices begin to tick up, then we're going to find that a city which must feed itself from global food markets, it's just impossible to grow that much amount of food along the Nile and in Egypt, is going to be face severe starvation right on the borders of Europe. So it is something that we have to care about and think about in the near future. We mustn't blind ourselves to the fact that we have made substantial progress on hunger over the last 20 years or so. Now, still, probably a billion people go to bed calorie hungry at night. So we've made progress, but not enough. We've made less progress in malnutrition. So a country like India, where calorie hunger hasn't completely disappeared, but largely has disappeared, far less progress in undernutrition. And I won't say anything more about it, but issues of obesity and overnutrition. Countries like Mexico, where average lifespan was going up, it's now beginning to plateau because of the diseases of obesity coming in. And all these demand-side pressures are going to be happening at exactly the same time as we're going to see pressures on the supply side, pressures on agriculture. Water is the thing that's going to rear up and bite us first. We can already see major water issues in various places. The northwest of India, a highly productive breadbasket at the moment, the water table is going down in places by a meter a year. And the old joke, we don't make land anymore, there's increasing competition for land, and we do stupid things to our soil, things which we have the capacity and knowledge to avoid. And of course, we have to have greater resilience to shocks. We need resilience to climate change. The one thing we know about climate change is that the frequency of extreme events is going to go up. We don't know when they will occur, but we need a more resilient climate, more resilient food production system to climate change and to human shocks. Remember that 15% of all wheat that goes into international markets comes through the Crimea. Now, hopefully that's not going to be a problem, but it is a bit scary. So I've plotted here a graph of global food prices. This is Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN statistics over the last 30 years or so. And look at the blue line for the moment. That's what we experience. It's sort of inflation-adjusted food prices. Since the 2008, when there was this food price hike, food prices have gone up, they've fluctuated, and they've remained quite high. We're paying more for food than we did 10 years ago. But actually, we in the rich world, in the UK, we spend 10% of our incomes on food. Probably in no civilization, since money was invented, have people spent less on food than we do today. So most of us who enjoy reasonable incomes, that doesn't make a lot of difference. It does for the poorest 10% in society, and we can just see that if you go to our city centres. Now, the red line is when you don't adjust for inflation. And of course, economists adjust for inflation, but there's a technical argument that actually, if you adjust for rich world inflation, that's not what people in the poorest part of the world. So if you're one of those poor people in a slum, informal community in Cairo, who's having to buy food that ultimately comes from global food markets, the effect that it's having on your disposable income is nearer the red than the blue, or somewhere in between the two. So yes, the future may be here already. We may be beginning to see some of the issues with food prices going ahead. Now, of course, if you're an economist, you will say, well, the economic system will respond to increasing demand by producing more food. And that's true. So we will see some economic response. But what worries me is that there are many market failures. That response may do terrible things to the environment, and it may miss out especially on the poorest people. And that's why the title of the talk is How Can We Feed People, 10 Billion People, Sustainably into the Future and Equitably, so that the poorest and those with the least power don't get excluded. And I have three slides to just very, very briefly. It's such a big topic, I can just sort of sketch some of the things that I think need to happen. And the first is on the supply side. We will have to produce more food. We will have to produce more food from the same amount of land. Now, in the past, and again, Yavinder showed us very well, when we needed more food, we brought more food into agriculture. But we're at the end game now. Now, of course, we can actually convert more land to agriculture. We could cut down the Congo. We could cut down the Amazon. We could drain some of our remaining wetlands. But as Nicholas Stearns, Lord Stearns, said in his report a few years ago, there is no better way of getting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than to cut down a rainforest. So we're going to have to produce more food. We're going to have to do it from the same agricultural footprint. And I call that sustainable intensification. It's a contested term. Some people don't like it. But if you don't like the term, it's just producing more food from the same footprint with less harm on the environment. And there are two ways we need to do that. We need to close the yield gap. Many areas of agriculture do not produce as much food as they could do at the moment because they lack, especially in least developing countries, the infrastructure, the market access. We need to reverse the lack of investment in agriculture, especially in least developed countries. And we have to increase the human capital, actually in rich countries as well as in poor countries. And we need new knowledge. We need new knowledge at the high end, the science end, and at the sort of agronomic end. We need to take the best of what the organic movement has shown, how we can look after our soils better. I believe we need to take the best from what high-tech, biotech can give us. I don't think we have the luxury of being ideological about food production and say it can only be GM or only organic. I'm intensely suspicious of magic bullets. I think we have to take the best from whatever we can and question it and see what works. Going back to a theme of Yavinder's talk, we've got to get serious about reducing demand. And there are different components of demand. There is issues of population, largely in Africa. There is such a positive message that one can make about population. 30 or 40 years ago, when we talked about population, we talked about coercion. We talked about one-child policies. There is a really positive message you can give about population. Educate girls, bring people out of poverty, provide access to reproductive health care, then you get this virtuous circle. We have to be serious about reducing consumption in the rich world. And if I was to go for one thing, it would be we need to eat less meat. Now, I could never be a vegetarian. I love meat, but we try and eat meat less frequently than we did. I think we should all nationally try and eat less of the foods that have a greater impact on the environment. And somewhere where we actually do pretty well in the UK. UK and the Netherlands, I think, are the best countries in boring down on waste. We waste somewhere, you see large figures, I actually think we probably waste about 20 to 25% of food, and some of that you can't get rid of. But we should bore down on the waste that we can do. Again, it's not a magic bullet, but we have to do something in that area. And then finally, there is a whole issue of how we have a global food system that is both efficient in the sense of providing food for everyone and fair in the sense of the rich, the powerful, not distorting the whole system. And I could be about, I could do about 10 slides on this, and I've just brought up three things that I think are really important. I'm very influenced by the American, to the left, economist Joe Stiglitz. People are worried about globalization. Stiglitz says, we have globalization. We can't go back. It's just there. Take it, and then the argument is, how do you make globalization work? How do you craft the rules of globalization so that it produces public goods, so it produces equity? And I think as we try and craft international trade, how we impose tariffs and taxes on foods, that's a real thing to campaign for. It's no point in saying we need to stop globalization. We have it. The real challenge is how do we craft the systems? How do we manage shared resources? It's normally I'm a scientist, and I stand on a stage like this and say we need more money for research. When it comes to fisheries, we actually know pretty well how to manage fisheries. We just don't have the political will to impose the difficult decisions. So that's a real challenge. How do we manage shared resources, whether it's shared good resources, such as fisheries in the high seas, or shared bad resources, such as carbon and greenhouse gases? And then finally, I mean, we're in one of the most beautiful parts of the UK, in a high-income country, and we would not get this countryside round here unless we had something like the Common Agricultural Policy. So it's quite legitimate for us in the rich world to want to subsidize our rural communities in a way that to maintain our countryside. But how can we do that in a way that doesn't distort global markets and doesn't in particular act negatively against the people in the poorest? And I have to say that when one looks at the way we do it at the moment with the Common Agricultural Policy, you could cry at the amount of money we waste that could be spent in a better way. And what really makes me cry is that you talk to NFU, you talk to the environmental organizations, and everyone sort of knows this, and everyone sort of knows what's to be done. But it's such a complex, inertial system to move, and everyone's worried about making the first move. And so it's very, very unsexy to say we must get up and campaign about the Common Agricultural Policy. But if you care about the environment, if you care about food in the UK, it may be unsexy, but it needs to be done. So my final slide, so the conclusions. The food system is entering uncharted waters. And to go back to my last point, I think too often we're fighting the battles of the last 40 years, where the problem was, for example, in the European community, overproduction of food, rather than how we're going to cope with global demand for food. So, like generals, we're fighting the last war, not the future war. Again, to repeat, distrust anyone who says all we need to do is to produce more food. Agritech can solve everything. All we need to do is to get rid of waste. All we need to do is to transfer to a utopian agrarian economy. None of them are going to work. We need action on all fronts. We are where we are. We have to move from where we are. And to me, the only way of doing that is to attack all the different components of the food system, which means sustainably increasing food production, which means new thinking on consumption and governance. So can we feed 10 billion? The question I posed at the beginning. To coin a phrase, yes, we can, but only if we make some hard decisions. I'm in my mid-50s. I'm more optimistic now when I was a student in my early 20s, largely because of the population slowdown, the demographic transition. I think everything's to pay for. If someone was writing the history of humanity a couple of thousand years in time in the future, our generation, our children's generation, probably the next generation after that. Again, you saw those hockey stick graphs that Yuvinda showed. It really is a critical time. If we screw it up in the next couple of generations, then we'll have screwed it up for good. And then my final point is, so my background, actually very similar to Yuvinda's, we're both biologists. I care deeply about biodiversity. Many of you will have other things you care deeply about. Many of you care deeply about human rights in different areas. Whatever you care about, if we get food wrong, then forget that. If we fail on food, we fail on everything. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles. So I think we have now about 20 minutes for panel questions from the audience. Perhaps we'll take them in about two or three questions at a time.
Can we have some lights on the audience as well, so we're not blinking like frogs in the rainforest? Thank you.
I think I've got the mic
over there.
Possession is 9 points to the law. A question on food. You are talking about market failures in the global production of food systems, and I wonder if you'd be more specific. So we saw, in fact, from your charts, that the global price of food has actually gone up enormously and stayed high. And one might have thought that from a lot of the pronouncements, particularly about those who feel very strongly, that one of the problems of food production, particularly in Africa, is that the farmers get very totally inadequate prices. Now, one would have thought that would have helped in that direction, that they might have got better prices. But I think you said that, in fact, it doesn't always happen because of market failures. I just wonder if you could be more specific and give some examples of how those market failures screw up the system.
Yes, certainly. Let me give you a specific...
Should I take a couple more questions?
Oh, sorry. Yes, you've been there. Pardon.
You suggest various things that need to be done. I wonder to what extent what you suggest is limited by the scarcity of water.
Okay. And just to follow on from the first question... Do you think we're getting near a stage where food production shouldn't be governed by market forces at all, but there should be some sort of global overlord overseeing it?
I'll take the food one, then you might do the water one. Thanks. And I'll take them in reverse order. And, well, if I believe there was a global overlord who could do it, then I would agree with you. But the experiments that we've tried in global overlords, such as Joseph Stalin, doesn't give us great confidence that it might work. I actually believe that if you can set up if you can regulate the market so that the natural market forces lead in the right direction, then the efficiencies in markets that we've known about ever since the work of Adam Smith are really valuable, and that is a way of making very, very efficient efficient food production and distribution. But the $100 million question is, how do you regulate intelligently the market to avoid the market failures that the first gentleman asked about? And you asked specifically about poor food producers in Africa. They should benefit from increasing markets, but they don't have the capacity to respond. And there are a series of market failures there. There is a sort of governance market failure that it's not an enabling environment that allows economic investment to come in and connect farmers to markets. There is a failure of social capital as well. There is not the organizational capacity within the country to respond to markets. And there is a failure of human capital as well, just the skills that you need to change it. Now that's a bad comment about the picture overall. There are some fabulous examples in particular places. So I actually work a bit in Kenya, actually, on malaria rather than food. And I can get a better mobile phone signal in my field site there than 10 miles south of Oxford, where I live. And the farmers there are getting really interesting market information, agronomic information, weather information through their mobile phones. And one's beginning to see there the capacity for poor people to respond to what is an opportunity. But when you crunch the numbers, then when the cost of commodities goes up, it has worse rather than good effects on poor countries in Africa, at least at the moment.
On water, there's a chapter in the book by Mark New which specifically looks at freshwater use and freshwater demand. And certainly a freshwater supply, I think, is one of these planetary boundaries that we're hitting up against. Until the 1950s, freshwater use more or less tracked population. But since then, it's been going much faster than population. And that's because of the shift to irrigated systems. And it's a mixed system because it's this intensified irrigation in dry areas such as around the Nile and in other arid regions that actually has boosted food production. But inevitably, there are limits to this. And a lot of it's also been driven off aquifers and sort of mining temporary water resources. So certainly, it's one of the boundaries that we have to consider. Okay, so we take... Your
graph of how much of the world's energy we're using in terms of the biosphere missed out the oceans, and they provide about half the global primary productivity. What difference would it make if you included the oceans in those calculations of the human footprint on the planet?
Yes, that's a very good point. Two more. Yeah, you correct me this time as well. Keep each other in check.
And your son wants to ask a question.
I've got one here. Sorry. I wanted to ask about the phrase sustainable intensification and if you think that that idea can really apply to meat and dairy production.
One more.
Everything you say, everything both of you say, makes perfect sense to me. But do you ever get access to the politicians and the multi-global organisations, commercial organisations, that could actually, the people that have power, do you ever get access to them to persuade them? And if not, what do the rest of us do?
Do you want to start off with?
I'll take the oceans question first. Yes, I focused, using the metrics I did, I focused on land because in terms of primary productivity, our influence still is overwhelmingly on the land, where we actually clear land to convert to agricultural uses. We have a huge impact on the oceans, but it's at a higher trophic level. We don't tend to mine phytoplankton in the same way. But it's certainly if you tracked back the phytoplankton that are needed to support the fish that we do consume, you could argue that there's a very large impact on the oceans as well. I don't have the numbers at hand, but it would be certainly comparable.
On sustainable intensification in livestock, there are a number of things you could do. One is you could switch to the livestock that has less greenhouse gas emissions, actually going from red meat to white meat. It's complex, but that's a good line. There are ways in which you can just manage your pasture land that can reduce emissions. And looking ahead to new knowledge, then there's some quite exciting things that could be done. So one of the main greenhouse gases is methane. Methane is produced a lot by the ruminant cattle because of the bacteria in their gut. And it might be you can just, even using quite low-tech techniques, change the microflora in the gut so that less greenhouse gases are produced. This is an area with a lot of research going on at the moment, and afterwards I'm very happy to push you to suggest some things if it's an area you're particularly interested in. On the question of talking to people in power and things like that, we're both at Oxford, and it's interesting, a university like Oxford and other universities has changed tremendously in the last 20 years, and that we still do sort of basic research, which is our sort of core niche, but universities such as ours now have major programs in which we try and engage with people. And it's very much a two-way street in that both politicians, people from the private sector are interested in what research happens. And but I wouldn't want to overemphasize that the influence we have. And to me, if really major change is going to take place in the next couple of decades, then it's going to be that civil society allows the politicians to make choices which are politically impossible at the moment. And it's not an exact analogy, but I think it's a useful analogy to take to consider smoking. Now, we've known that smoking kills us since the late 60s, as a fact, essentially. And it's really only in the last decade or so that we have empowered our politicians to do things as to such as stopping smoking in restaurants. I like to say that the two most extraordinary things that have happened in my adult intellectual life are the speed of the demographic transition and the fact that you can't smoke in a restaurant in Paris.
I'll just follow on with a couple of comments on that last point as well. One role that I've had is in the UN climate conferences and advising various government delegations. And as Charles says, it isn't simply a matter of academics persuading leaders and then they're taking action. These are genuinely complex problems. And one of the reasons why the climate process has been so painfully slow is that it isn't just about finding a problem and finding a solution. It's about building a governance system at a global scale that meets the needs of justice, historical responsibilities, maintaining health and development, maintaining economic growth. And we simply don't have those governance structures in place at the scale that we need. You know, we have governance at the scale of nations or groups of nations at best, but the challenges we face are international. And so it's genuinely, whether through civil society or academia or governance, we're all feeling our way through, trying to work out what's a good way of governing this planet with these new challenges. Okay, I think we have time for another.
I have a microphone. Can I start? Yeah, the way you're saying in response to the question about how aware are the multinationals, how aware are the politicians of, you know, the urgency to work together on these issues with research. So I wanted just a comment maybe on any success stories. Have you had any really positive responses from members of private companies that are actually really engaging with you? I have another question. What you're talking about livestock and whether you can sustain it, what is the role of livestock and pasture management? And something I was quite interested in is the soil degradation side. How, you know, because yeah, we have this specific land area that we need to sustainably intensify. We can't keep grabbing more land, but there's also a big problem with land degradation and desertification, especially in Africa. So, one thing I can't remember which researcher, but he showed that actually livestock can be really beneficial for soil health and for preventing, for recovering soil degradation and desertification. So, I wondered what are your comments on using livestock in that way?
Okay.
You were saying like we could stop eating as much food by we could do lots of little things to stop using as much food and like eating red meat. Can you like name some of the things like we could do in our daily life to like help stop that?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. One more.
My question was similar to the oceans one. I just wanted you to clarify the 120% number that you had if we all lived like the US. Presumably, that is they're using a level of energy that is equivalent to the world without humans running the biological metabolism of that, right? So if we're using solar energy or nuclear energy, presumably that 120% is viable. It's not, it becomes impossible at 100%, right?
Yes, okay.
So the First Lady asked, are there successes in the private sector? And yes, there are particular companies who have done some really good things. I'm just going to pick one, because it's almost invidious to do this. But Unilever, the CEO of Unilever is a man called Paul Polman, and he's brought in some environmental accounting within the company, so they know much better exactly the consequence of what they're doing to different environmental things. And the single thing which I'm most impressed about is that he says, well, we're going to run this company more for the long term, so we're not going to report our figures every quarter as every company does. We're going to report them annually. And I think that one of the issues about we just need so much new economic thinking, and we have to break out of some of the short-termism and some of the dysfunctional parts of the current way that we organise our corporate sector. And I think in particular this mania on short-term quarterly reporting, where many of the stockholders of a company, the average time they've held shares can be of a matter of weeks rather than as it used to be years. You also asked about livestock and soil degradation. Now, it must be clear that in many places, much of the worst soil degradation is due to livestock and overstocking. So overstocking is one of the easiest ways to destroy your soils. But you're exactly right that where you do it properly, where you have appropriate livestock densities, you can get soils that build up carbon and do all sorts of things. So it's not a livestock always good, always bad. It's just getting it right and sort of integrated management of the agricultural environment. The young gentleman at the front who asked a question, I happen to know, is Yavinda's son. And he asked what we can all do. Well, I gave you one, so I'm going to give you a general and a specific thing. And the general thing is if one... you can give the same answer actually for both in health and environment. So if you eat more vegetable, eat food, not too much, largely plants. I mean, it's really gives you 95% of the diet advice you need. But I'd be very interesting if you could report back to me your father's meat consumption over the next couple of months, and then we could perhaps have a chat about it after that. Over to you, Yavinda.
Okay, I'll move on from that one. So the question about the energy consumption in the US. Currently, the US actually has about, per unit area, about a quarter the energy consumption of the UK, or of England. And that's because of large land areas, there's vast areas of cropland and relatively empty spaces in the US. So that number came from taking the per-person energy consumption and projecting it onto a global population of around 10 billion. And off that energy consumption, about half of it comes directly from the biosphere, food production, essentially, both directly or indirectly through cattle. And the other half is through fossil fuel energy. So clearly, one of the transitions that would knock that 100... it would still be that much energy use, but would knock down where that energy comes from, is that that fossil fuel use comes from something that doesn't as much waste product. So moving to a system, whether it's solar or wind or fusion or whatever, that doesn't have that metabolic waste that fossil fuel combustion has, is one of those key transitions. So there is a case for reducing energy demand. But clearly, I think there are arguments for saying that we simply can't have a world population at that level of energy consumption per capita. But there's another case of shifting the energy source to other sources that don't have the consequences. And that's clearly part of the transition that we have to make.
Sorry, 120% doesn't mean it's impossible or everything else on the planet is dead. Is that
no, it highlights, I think, but since I don't think we can approach 100% of our biosphere anyway, because there'd be nothing left for the rest of the biosphere. It's not the planet we want to live on. So realistically, in terms of our impact on the biosphere, 20-30% is really, I think, probably the sort of soft limit we want to be at. And it's really how we shift where we get the energy from to support the standards of living that we're used to around that.
So I fear that we need to end there. Can I thank you for a series of really interesting questions? If you want to hear more about some of the things that Yavinda and I have talked about, or Sarah Harper earlier today, Ian Golden earlier in the week talked about, then do have a look at the book. Also, if you're interested, do have a look at the Oxford University website, the Oxford Martin School website, the Oxford Network in the Environment. There's a lot of material there, some of it more technical, but a lot of it aimed for people who are just interested in these issues, which really affect all of us. So thank you very much indeed.